I want you to visualize your portfolio right now. Just, open up the brokerage app in your mind. You're looking at that list of tickers. You've got your absolute best idea, the company you know cold, the one you've researched for 50 hours, the one with the management team you trust with your kids' college fund.
I think every investor has that one, the crown jewel.
Exactly. And then you scroll down a bit, and you've got your 10th best idea. Maybe it's something you read about on a blog once, or a tip from a neighbor, or just a stock you bought 3 years ago and kind of forgot about.
Well, when you sort of hope just goes away so you don't have to think about it.
Yeah. Here is the question that kicks off everything we're talking about today. And it's a question that might actually make you angry. Why do you have those two ideas, the absolute best one and the 10th best one, in your portfolio at the exact same weight?
It is the uncomfortable question. It's the one we actively, avoid asking ourselves.
It's the hidden variable. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are tackling a monster of a topic. We are looking at a series of posts from averagingup.com, written by Mr. Jocelyn Dubey, the author of The Infinite Investor. And this isn't just stock tips. This is portfolio architecture.
And to be clear, this is for the serious investor. Dubey isn't writing for the day trader flipping meme stocks. He's writing for the intellectually curious capital allocator who wants rigor.
And this specific deep dive is focused on the first post in a series he wrote titled Position Sizing: The Final Act of Conviction.
The final act of conviction. I mean, what a title.
It hits hard because, let's be honest, we spend 99% of our time obsessing over selection. We read the 10-Ks, we listen to the earnings calls, we argue about competitive advantages on Twitter, we obsess over what to buy.
We treat selection as the main event. The buy decision is the dopamine hit. It's the fun part.
But Dubey's argument, and it's a provocative one, is that we systematically neglect sizing. We treat how much to own as an afterthought.
It really is. It's usually just fill it up to 5% or whatever cash I have left.
Which is incredibly dangerous because, and this is the core thesis we need to unpack right at the start, getting the stock right and the size wrong produces the exact same economic result as getting the stock wrong. Whoa, hold on. Let's pause there. That sounds like hyperbole.
It does.
If I buy a stock and it goes up 50%, I made money. If I pick a loser, I lose money. How can you tell me that getting the size wrong is the same as being wrong? That doesn't track for me.
It feels harsh, doesn't it? But it is mathematically true if we look at the portfolio level. And we have to start with what he calls the fundamental postulate from the source material. Most people think their portfolio return is the average of their stock picks. It
Well,
isn't.
the sum of the parts, right?
It is a weighted average. And that word weighted is the key. The weight is the multiplier. If the weight is zero or close to zero, the return is zero, no matter how good the pick was. Let's walk through the example Dubey gives because it illustrates this perfectly. Imagine two investors, investor A and investor B. They both own the exact same five stocks, same tickers, same market, same year.
Okay, so their selection skill is identical. They both found the same opportunities.
Identical. Now, let's say in this specific year, one of those stocks is a rocket ship. It returns 30%.
A huge winner.
A huge winner. Another one is a complete dog. It loses 10%. And the other three are just kind of flat doing nothing.
Sounds like a pretty standard market year. You win some, you lose some.
Exactly. Now, look at investor A. She has calibrated conviction. She puts 40% of her capital into that 30% gainer. She identified it as the winner and she backed up the truck.
She bet big.
She bet big and she puts token amounts in the rest. Her result for the year, she's up 14.6%. She absolutely crushed the market.
Because she sized her best idea correctly.
Now look at investor B. He has the same stocks, but he put 40% of his capital into the stock that lost 10%. Maybe he thought it was a value play. Maybe he was anchoring to a past price. Who knows? He put token amounts in the winner. His result, he lost money.
That is wild. Same analysis, same stocks. One makes almost 15%, the other loses money.
And the only difference was the weighting. This is why Dubey calls sizing the multiplier. It converts your theoretical analysis into an actual economic outcome. Without sizing, your stock picking is just an intellectual exercise. It's just an opinion. Sizing is what makes it real.
It's like, okay, imagine a chef. You can have the best ingredients in the world, the best flour, the best chocolate, the best sugar. But if you mess up the ratios, if you put in 2 cups of salt and a teaspoon of flour, you don't have a cake. You have a disaster.
That is the perfect analogy. The weights determine the product. And yet, how do most people size their positions?
Randomly. Or, honestly, usually out of fear. I don't want to lose too much, so I'll just put a little bit in everything.
Precisely. We size by accident or by default. And that brings us to the architecture. Dubé doesn't just say, size better. I mean, that's not helpful. He gives us a structure. He calls it the architecture.
Okay.
He breaks the portfolio down into four distinct functional categories or buckets.
I love frameworks like this because it stops you from just having a messy list of stocks.
Mm.
But I have to warn you, when I read the source material, the first bucket made me bristle a little bit.
Bucket number one.
Bucket number one, cash. He targets a weight of 10 to 25%.
Yes.
25% cash in this economy. I mean, we have inflation running at 3%, sometimes 4% or higher. If I'm holding a quarter of my portfolio in cash, I'm losing purchasing power every single day.
Mm-hmm.
My financial advisor would scream at me about cash drag. He'd say that money is dead weight.
And this is where Dubé completely reframes the conversation. And you really have to shift your mindset to understand this. He argues that cash is not drag and it is not idle capital. He calls it the infinite option.
The infinite option. That sounds like a sci-fi movie title. What does he actually mean by that? Because an option in finance, it usually costs money.
Think about what a call option is. You pay a premium money out of your pocket to have the right, but not the obligation, to buy a stock later at a certain price.
Right.
Cash is an option on the future that never expires, and crucially, it carries no premium. It costs you nothing to hold the option itself, other than the inflation erosion you mentioned.
But that erosion is real. That's a real cost.
It is real, but compare it to the cost of not having cash. The strategic value of cash is that it benefits from chaos. When the market crashes, when everyone else is forced to sell because they are leveraged or terrified, cash allows you to be the one buying.
So it's potential energy waiting to be kinetic.
It's ammunition. He points to Warren Buffett. Buffett often holds over $150 billion in cash. People criticize him for it constantly. They say, Warren, you're losing to inflation. Put that money to work.
And he just ignores them.
Because that cash is what allowed him to buy Bank of America during the 2011 crisis when they were on their knees. It's what allowed him to buy huge stakes in Occidental Petroleum in 2022.
Right.
If he had been fully invested, if he had zero cash drag, he would have been a spectator during those crises. Because he held the infinite option, he was a participant.
So cash isn't about timing the market. It's about being able to act when the market breaks.
Exactly. It's the only asset that correlates negatively with market distress. When everything else goes down, the relative purchasing power of your cash goes through the roof. If stocks drop 50%, your cash just doubled in value in terms of what it can buy.
Okay, I can see the logic there. It's psychological insurance as much as financial. So that's bucket one, cash.
Mm-mm.
Bucket two is the index. He's just 10 to 20% here.
Yeah.
Now, wait a minute. We are doing a deep dive on stock picking.
Right.
If we are active investors, why are we buying the index? Isn't that admitting defeat?
Dubé calls the index the engine, but he also refers to it as humility expressed as a position.
Humility. I like that word, but I don't like paying fees for it. Why do we need it?
We have to look at the data. We have to face the brutal reality of the Bessembinder study.
Oh, the study that hurts every stock picker's feelings.
It really does. It's tough to read. Professor Hendrik Bessembinder looked at the entire history of the U.S. stock market, and he found that roughly 4% of publicly traded stocks generate all net market wealth creation above treasury bills.
Wait, repeat that. 4%.
4%. That means 96% of stocks, the vast majority of companies you have ever heard of, collectively match or trail the return of a boring treasury bill over the long run.
That's existential dread.
Yeah.
That means if I just pick stocks at random, or even if I'm just average at picking,
yeah,
I am statistically almost guaranteed to lose to the market.
Correct. The odds are stacked against the stock picker. The distribution of returns is just incredibly skewed. A few super winners carry the entire market.
So why do we even try?
Well, we try because if you find those 4%, you win big. But Dubé includes the index bucket to acknowledge that difficulty. The index is a self-cleansing system. It automatically removes companies that are failing, they drop out of the S&P 500, and it automatically amplifies the winners because it's market cap weighted. By holding the index, you guarantee you have exposure to that 4% of super winners without needing to predict who they are.
It's insurance against your own stupidity, essentially. Or bad luck.
It's a floor. It ensures that no matter how bad your individual picks are, a portion of your capital is participating in the broad upward march of capitalism. It keeps you in the game.
Okay, so we have our defense, which is cash.
Yeah.
And our floor, the index. Now let's get to the offense. This is what we're here for. Bucket three, compounders. This is the core.
This is where the magic happens. He suggests 5 to 10% weighting per position here. These are your high conviction holdings.
Before we get into how to pick them, let's talk about the math again. Why 5 to 10%? Why not 2%? If I find a great company, isn't owning a little bit better than nothing?
We need to talk about the math of compounding. Real compounding. Let's say you find a business that can grow its intrinsic value at 20% a year.
Which is a Hall of Fame number.
It's incredible. Over 10 years, a business compounding at 20% roughly quadruples in value. It's actually a bit more, about a factor of 6.
Wow.
Over 20 years, it multiplies by a factor of nearly 40.
40 times your money.
Now, imagine you own that company. It's the best idea you ever had. But you only put 0.5% of your portfolio into it because you wanted to be diversified.
Okay, so I have a $100,000 portfolio.
Yeah.
I put $500 into the stock.
Right. Fast forward 20 years, that $500 becomes $20,000. That's a great return.
Yeah.
But your portfolio is now probably worth $1 million or $2 million just from inflation and regular growth. That $20,000 gain, it's a rounding error. It didn't change your life.
It paid for a nice vacation, but it didn't let me retire early.
Exactly. But if you had sized that position at $10,000 and it went up 40x, now you have $400,000 from a single idea. That changes your zip code.
Right.
The logic is simple. If you have identified a compounding machine, you must own enough of it for the compounding to actually matter to your financial life.
You can't just admire the machine from a distance. You have to strap yourself to it.
Precisely. You have to let the math work for you.
Okay, that brings us to the final bucket. Bucket four. Amplifiers. These are the asymmetric bets. Target weight. 1 to 3% each.
These are your speculative positions. High potential, high risk of failure. This is the extreme right tail of the distribution.
Give me a concrete example of the difference between a compounder and an amplifier, because sometimes they can look similar.
A compounder is something like Costco or Visa. You know it's going to be there in 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
The range of outcomes is fairly narrow and mostly positive. It might grow 10%, it might grow 15%, but it's really unlikely to go bankrupt next Tuesday.
It's boring but effective.
An amplifier is a small biotech firm trying to cure a specific type of cancer, or a junior miner looking for gold in Nevada, or a distress play, a company that might go bankrupt, but if it survives, it triples.
Oh, it's binary. It could go to the moon or it could go to zero.
Exactly. And the sizing logic here is the inverse of the compounder. With a compounder, you size up because you are confident in the durability. With an amplifier, you size down because you acknowledge the uncertainty. You want it small enough that if it goes to zero, which is a very real possibility, it doesn't hurt you.
If I lose 1% of my portfolio, I'll survive.
You'll have a bad afternoon, but you won't lose your retirement. But you want it large enough that if it does a 10x or 20x, it moves the needle.
There's a ceiling here, though. He says an amplifier at 8% is an uncontrolled concentration.
That's a critical rule. If you have a speculative bet something with a real chance of zero, and it's taking up 8 or 10% of your portfolio, you are taking on existential risk. You are betting the house on a coin flip.
Right.
That's not investing. That's gambling.
So to recap the architecture, cash for options, index for humility, compounders for wealth creation, amplifiers for spice.
Correct. A very nice summary.
And that structure leads us directly into the biggest problem most investors face. And I have to say, I felt personally attacked when I read this section. The problem of false equality.
It's a very common pathology. It's the tendency to size all positions equally. You know, you say, I have 20 stocks, so I'll put 5% in each one.
But wait, why is that bad? It feels disciplined. It feels like I'm being fair to my ideas. It feels like good risk management because I'm not overexposed to any single one.
Dubé calls it intellectual dishonesty.
Ouch. That stings. Why is it dishonest?
Because if you have done the work, you know that your ideas are not equal. You know that business A has a monopoly, a great CEO, and high margins. And you know that business B is fighting a price war and has a lot of debt.
Sure.
If you size them both at 5%, You are lying to yourself. You are discarding your own analysis. You are saying, I know A is better than B, but I'm going to act as if they are the same.
So I'm essentially hedging against my own conviction.
And this is where we get that classic Charlie Munger quote. The idea of excessive diversification is madness.
Right.
Going into your seventh one rather than putting more money into your first is a terrible mistake.
Munger's pointing out the opportunity cost.
Exactly. If you put money into your 20th best idea, where is that money coming from? It's coming from the pool of capital that could have gone into your best idea. You are diversifying away from quality.
True risk management isn't just spreading your bets as wide as possible.
Mm-hmm.
It's concentrating your exposure where your probability of being right is highest.
Correct. But with a survival constraint, of course.
No. Of course. So we need a hierarchy, a gradient of conviction. The best idea gets the most capital. But how do we decide? This is the hard part. It's easy to say, pick the best one. But how do I know if a stock deserves 5% or 10%?
This is where Dubé provides a calibration mechanism. This is the how-to manual. He gives us four specific criteria to determine the rank of a compounder.
Let's unpack these one by one, because this is the toolkit our listeners need to actually use. Criterion number one, width of the moat.
And he's very specific here. It's not just, do they have a brand? It's about the source of the protection and the certainty of it.
He lists several types. Let's look at consumer franchise, like Coca-Cola.
Right. Coca-Cola isn't a monopoly. You can buy Pepsi, you can buy water, you can buy Dr. Pepper, but Coca-Cola has a share of mind. It's a consumer franchise so deep that they have pricing power without needing a monopoly.
But that requires constant maintenance, right? Advertising, marketing.
Constant maintenance. Compare that to network effects. Visa is the classic example here. The network effects are more structural. Every time a merchant accepts Visa, the card becomes more valuable to you. Every time you get a card, the network becomes more valuable to the merchant. It's a feedback loop that creates a winner-take-all dynamic. This is generally a stronger moat than just a brand name.
He also mentions switching costs. This one is my favorite because it's so nasty, like SAP or Oracle.
It's the pain moat. Have you ever tried to rip an ERP system out of a corporate headquarters?
No, but I've heard horror stories. It sounds like open-heart surgery on the business.
It is. It's painful, expensive, and risky. It can shut down the business for weeks if it goes wrong. Once a company installs SAP, they are never leaving. They will pay price hike after price hike just to avoid the pain of switching.
That is an incredibly durable moat.
So when we are sizing, we need to ask, how certain am I that this moat will hold for 20 years? A network effect or high switching costs might deserve a 10% weight. A brand that could fade might only deserve 5%.
Okay. Criterion number two, level and durability of ROIC. Return on invested capital.
This is the engine. If a company takes a dollar of capital and turns it into $1.20, that's a 20% ROIC. But Dubé makes a critical distinction here between compounding behind a fortress versus compounding on an open plain.
I love that imagery. Explain the difference.
Compounding on an open plain means you have high returns, but competitors are watching. They see your 20% returns and they say, I want some of that. They enter the market, they lower prices, and your returns get competed away.
So the ROIC drops from 20% to 10% over time.
Exactly. But compounding behind a fortress means you have high returns and you are protected by patents, regulations, or a unique asset that cannot be copied. The competitors can't enter.
So a 40% ROIC behind a fortress deserves a much higher weight than a 40% ROIC that's about to get attacked.
Durability matters more than the absolute level. I'd rather own a 20% ROIC that is guaranteed for 20 years than a 50% ROIC that will disappear in 3 years.
Makes sense. Criterion number three, runway of reinvestment.
This is the fuel. ROIC is the engine. Runway is the fuel.
Explain that.
Imagine a company that earns 50% on its capital. Amazing, right? But what if it owns a single bridge? It can't build another bridge. It can't reinvest that cash to earn 50% again. It just has to pay it out as dividends.
So the compounding stops.
It stops. It becomes a bond. You want a business that can take that 20% return and put it back into the business to earn 20% again next year and the year after that. You want a structurally expanding market.
So if I'm looking at a company that has saturated its market, even if it's profitable, I should size it smaller.
Yes. Because the exponential math we talked about earlier requires reinvestment. If they can't reinvest, the exponential curve flattens out.
And finally, criteria number four, specific risk. He calls this the discount or the ceiling.
This is crucial for risk management. Even if the moat is wide and the ROIC is high, does the business have a single point of failure?
Like a geopolitical dependency?
Exactly. Look at what happened to Russian stocks a few years ago. Or look at a company that depends on a single supplier for a critical component. If your factory is in a conflict zone, or if your entire business model depends on one specific regulation remaining unchanged.
You have a binary risk. It's a zero risk.
That risk acts as a ceiling. You might say, this is a great business, the metrics are perfect. But if China invades Taiwan, or if the FDA bans this chemical, the stock goes to zero. Therefore, you can never size it at 10%. You have to cap it at maybe 3 or 4%, no matter how good the moat is.
That makes total sense. It's the survival constraint.
So when you put these four together, you get your rank. An irreplaceable company with a wide moat, high durability, long runway, and low specific risk. That's your 8 to 10% position.
Okay.
A dominant company that's slightly less protected, maybe 5 to 8%. A solid company, 3 to 5%.
Anything below that.
Justify or exit. If it's not good enough to be a meaningful position, why do you own it?
Which leads us perfectly into the pathologies of the unmanaged portfolio.
Yeah.
Because if you don't do this ranking, if you just let things happen, your portfolio starts to get sick. Do A identifies five specific diseases. Let's diagnose them.
The first one is inversion. This is a tragic one. It's where your highest conviction ideas have the lowest weights and your lowest conviction ideas have the highest weights.
How does that happen? I mean, nobody does that on purpose.
It happens through fear and reflex. Yeah. Let's say you buy a mediocre stock. It drops 20%. It looks cheap. So you buy more to lower your average cost. You average.
I've done that. It's a bargain now.
So you pour more capital into the loser. Meanwhile, your best idea, the compounder, it goes up 20%. It looks expensive.
Right.
You get scared to buy more. You might even trim it to take profits.
You end up feeding the losers and starving the winners.
Exactly. The portfolio reflects the opposite of your judgment. You have the most money in the stuff you like the least, just because it went down.
Wow. Okay, pathology number two, drift. This is the do-nothing strategy.
Imagine you buy a speculative amplifier at 2%. Let's say it's that biotech stock. Suddenly they get FDA approval. The stock triples. It is now 6 or 7% of your portfolio.
I feel like a genius. I'm rich.
You feel great, but you have a risk problem. You now have a 7% position, a core position size in a high-risk, volatile, speculative stock. It has drifted from a controlled bet into a major risk.
But if I sell, I miss the upside.
If you don't do anything, you have accepted that new risk profile without actually making a decision. Drift is the absence of decision. Yeah. The market decided for you.
Pathology number three. Fragmentation, or as he calls it, the bookmark.
This is the portfolio with 40 or 50 stocks, and half of them are at 0.5% or 1%.
I am so guilty of this. I'll just buy a little bit to keep an eye on it. It's like a watch list that I paid for.
The bookmark. Dubé is brutal on this. He says a position at 0.5% is useless. Do the math. If a 0.5% position doubles a 100% return, it adds 0.5% to your total portfolio return.
That's nothing. A bad day in the market moves my portfolio more than that.
Exactly. Who cares? And if it goes to zero, you lose 0.5%. It doesn't matter financially.
But it takes up mental space.
That's the real cost. You're spending energy, tracking earnings, reading news, and worrying about a position that cannot financially impact your life.
If it's not worth a meaningful size, it's likely not worth owning. That hits home. Okay, pathology four, accidental concentration.
This is the flip side of drift. It's when a position grows to 25 or 30% of the portfolio just through inertia.
But isn't that a good thing? It means you won. Buffett has massive concentration.
It means you won in the past.
Yeah.
But the question is, are you comfortable with 30% of your net worth in this one company today? If the stock dropped 50% tomorrow, you would lose 15% of your entire net worth. Are you okay with that?
Usually the answer is, I didn't think about it.
Exactly. If the answer is yes, I know this company cold and I accept the risk, that's fine. That's a conscious decision. But usually it's, I'm just holding it because I have it. That is unexamined risk. Concentration should be a choice, not an accident.
And the final pathology we already touched on, false equality, the comfort of not ranking.
It's the emotional safety of saying, I love all my children equally. But in investing, your children are capital allocation vehicles and some are just better than others.
Okay, so we have diagnosed the diseases. We know we're sick. Now we need the cure. Section five, the corrective mechanism. Dubé proposes a dynamic system, not just a static set it and forget it. He talks about two disciplines, harvesting and averaging up.
These are the two engines of the portfolio, and they work in opposite directions for different buckets.
Let's start with harvesting. This is for the amplifiers, right?
Correct. When an amplifier that risky, speculative bet wins big, you must harvest.
Going back to my biotech stock, it went from 2% to 6%. What do I do?
You sell enough to bring it back down to a safe size. Maybe you trim it back to 3 or 4%.
Yeah.
You liberate the capital.
Why? Why kill the momentum? It feels wrong.
To prevent drift. To prevent that high-risk asset from becoming a core holding that could blow up your portfolio if it reverses. You take the house money off the table.
And where does that money go?
This is the beautiful part of the architecture. The money flows down the pyramid. You take profits from the high-risk apex, the amplifiers, and you move it down into the core, the compounders, or the base, the index, and cash.
So you are systematically moving money from lucky and risky to stable and durable.
Exactly. You are using luck to fund certainty.
Yeah.
You are solidifying your wealth.
Now let's talk about the other mechanism, the one that is going to be really, really hard for people to swallow. Averaging up. This is for the compounders?
This is the psychological heavy lifting.
Okay, walk me through this. I bought a compounder at $100. It's now $150. My brain is screaming, it's too expensive. I missed the boat. I'm not paying $150 for something I got for $100 last year.
That is the anchoring bias. You are anchored to that $100 price.
So I tell myself, I'll wait for a dip back to $120.
And then it goes to $200 and then $300. And you never buy another share. And you are left with a tiny, withered position in a massive winner.
So Dubé says I should buy at $150.
He argues that averaging up is the truth serum for conviction. But you have to look at the valuation, not the price.
Explain the math.
Let's say at $100, the company was earning $5 per share. So the P-E ratio was 20.
Okay, makes sense.
Now the stock is $150. But the earnings have grown to $7.50 per share. What is the P-E ratio?
150 divided by 750, it's still 20.
Exactly. The valuation hasn't changed. You are paying the same multiple for a more valuable business. The stock isn't expensive, it's just bigger.
That is a really helpful way to frame it. I've never thought of it that way.
If the compounding thesis holds, if the moat is intact, if the runway is clear, you should be happy to buy more at a higher price. In fact, the higher price confirms your thesis. It means you were right.
Averaging up forces capital into your highest conviction ideas. It fixes inversion and fragmentation in one single move.
It essentially forces you to double down on your winners instead of your losers. It aligns your capital with your success.
But we have to talk about the limits, because you shouldn't always average up. If I just blindly buy every time a stock goes up, I'm going to get burned.
Absolutely. There are strict rules here. First, never average up on an amplifier.
Why not? If the biotech stock works, why not buy more?
Because the risk is still binary. It's still a speculation. If you average up on a speculation, you are increasing your exposure to a potential zero. You want to harvest speculations, not feed them.
Got it. Rule two.
Never average up if the thesis has weakened. If the price is up but the earnings aren't, or if a competitor has breached the moat, do not add. Averaging up requires reconfirming the thesis. You have to re-underwrite the investment every single time.
Rule three.
Never average up into a grossly overvalued multiple. If that stock went from 100 to 150, but earnings stayed flat, the PE went from 20 to 30.
Right.
If it goes to 200, it's 40. Eventually, the price runs too far ahead of the business. The margin of safety is consumed. You hold, but you don't add.
And the final limit?
The survival constraint. Never average up past the point of survivability. No single position should ever be large enough to wipe you out. Dubé is very clear. A single position at 10% is conviction. A single position at 30% is existential risk.
Even if it's the best company in the world.
Even then, you don't let it become your entire world.
It's amazing how much of this comes down to psychology. We talked about false equality being about emotional safety. But there are other barriers Dubé mentions. Regret aversion seems huge here.
If I buy more at 150 and it drops to 130, I'll feel like an idiot. That's the fear.
I hate feeling like an idiot. It's the worst feeling as an investor.
But Dubé flips this. He says, consider the regret of missing a 100-bagger. The regret of watching a stock go from $100 to $10,000 and realizing you only own $500 worth of it.
Oh, that's a deeper pain.
That regret is permanent. That regret haunts you for decades. The regret of buying a dip is temporary.
You have to choose which regret you can live with.
Exactly.
And finally, the endowment effect on cash.
This is feeling like the cash you harvested from the amplifiers is house money or banked wins.
Yeah.
You put it in a savings account and say, I'm keeping this. It's safe now.
I earned this. I'm not risking it again.
But capital must cycle. If you harvest an amplifier and just sit on the cash forever, you break the machine. You have to redeploy it into the core. You have to feed the compounders.
This has been a massive unpack. Let's try to summarize the mission here, because this isn't just about spreadsheets.
The mission is to realize that sizing is the primary decision. It validates your analysis. If you move from a flat list of stocks, that false equality, to a structured pyramid where your capital matches your certainty, you have completely changed your game.
You've built a gradient of conviction.
Exactly. You are no longer just picking stocks. You are designing an economic outcome. You are an architect, not just a collector.
And here is the teaser. We talked a lot today about capital being a finite resource. You only have so much money to invest. But Dubé ends this post with a hint about the next one in the series. He says capital isn't the only finite resource.
No, it is not. Attention is also finite.
And those bookmarks we talked about, those tiny half-percent positions that don't make you any money, they aren't just financial deadweight, they are stealing your attention.
They carry a hidden attention cost. Every minute you spend reading about a half-percent position is a minute you aren't spending finding the next 10% position.
And next time, we are going to explore why your smallest positions might actually be the most expensive things you own.
It's going to be an uncomfortable conversation.
I can't wait. That's a wrap for this deep dive on position sizing. Go look at your portfolio, look at your weights, and ask yourself, is my best idea really getting my best capital?
Thanks for listening.
Stay rigorous.